And welcome. We're coming to you live from the Everybody Conference here in McKinnon 120 for keynote speaker Loretta Ross. And we're just about to go to the introductions. We're just setting up for the closed captioning of the keynote speaker. And then Loretta Ross will be coming to talk to us about bodily autonomy and reclaiming that through a human rights framework. And here we are.
There's a lot of really amazing people who put a lot of time and work into this conference, but also into supporting the people who put on this conference and who have inspired the people who put on this conference and who have allowed people to have the privilege that they do have to put on this conference. So thank you. That's amazing. There are a lot of specific organizations that put in a lot of time and effort, whether through resources, money, grants, to make this conference happen. So we'd like to acknowledge those groups. So we'd like to thank OPIR Guelph, the CSA, the Critical Knowledge Collective, Student Life, Guelph Queer Equality, the Student Support Network, the Student Life Enhancement Fund, the Special Speakers Fund, the Women Campus Safety Initiative, the Guelph Community Acupuncture, who will also still be giving acupuncture tomorrow for free, and the Peak. We'd also like to thank all the amazing facilitators who are coming here and coming from far and wide to be at this event. This event wouldn't be possible without them, and they have a lot of knowledge from us to take from. And we really want to thank the awesome RAD volunteers. If you've seen all of us running around, this event wouldn't be possible with the people who have stayed up really, really late, woken up really early in the morning, been sending emails while they're eating and trying to have conversations and all that. So there are so many of you to thank. Thank you so much, the conference organizers and volunteers, for putting in your time for making this event happen.
So we'd also like to acknowledge that while we did a lot of the work to get the grants, this money has landed in our hands because of exploitation that's inflicted on people worldwide. And that privilege we're awarded to be here today is very much on the backs of others. So it's complicated. Let's talk about it. We also want to acknowledge that the only reason we can be here today is because we're on stolen indigenous land. And so this land specifically was originally neutral territory, and it's also Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabeg territory. So we hope that during this conference we can have conversations about what that means for us and how that can influence our work and our survival. Yeah. So up next, you guys can read our speech right here. So Loretta, here's your bio that we put together.
We didn't really plan on this.
It's cool.
We also didn't finish separating the part. Oh, well.
Okay. Yeah, whatever.
So for folks who want to know a little bit about Loretta before she starts speaking, she has a 25-year history in the women's movement, both in ending violence against women and promoting reproductive justice in the United States and internationally. She has also been active in the Black nationalist and civil rights movements. Ross was one of the first African-American women to direct the first rape crisis center in the United States in the 1970s. From 1985 to 1999, she served as the director of Women of Color, as the director for the Women of Color programs. Oh, you cut me off.
Now sorry, I'm just going back to the bottom of the screen.
I don't know where to go. Organizing the first National Conference on Women of Color and Reproductive Rights in 1987. She's a founding member of Sister Song, which is an amazing group, and is a coalition of 80 grassroots women of color and allied organizations. In 2004, Loretta was national co-director of the April 25th, 2004 March for Women's Live in Washington, D.C., which was the largest protest in U.S. history with over 1 million participants. So, woo!
So she's also the author of many books, including Undivided Rights, Women of Color, Organizing for Reproductive Justice, and a chapter in The Color of Violence, the Insight Anthology. And those are two books that we have at the center that organize this. So if y'all want to check it out, you should. Okay, we're done. So Loretta Ross.
Thank you. While we get the technology arranged. (Clears throat) Before I start, I just want to make sure that we are still live on the closed captioning microphone. Send me a message if we're okay. Okay. We appear to be okay. Now, this is going to be rather embarrassing. I've never had anybody capture my words as I spoke them at the same time. And, you know, I don't have the cleanest mouth in the world, so I'm going to have to work to edit as I go. Or otherwise, they'll be in cyberspace forever. First of all, before I start, I should say that we have a mood minder in the audience. Heidi, would you please wave, Heidi? If anything I say triggers you or makes you want to seek some space or take care of yourself, we have a second one. Okay, thank you. Let you know that the organizers of the conference have thoughtfully arranged for mood minders so that even though you may have gone through your trauma by yourself, you don't have to re-experience it by yourself, which is often forgotten when people talk about healing, how alone we are when we are traumatized. And then sometimes people make us be alone to re-experience or to tell about it. And so it's definitely a step forward to understand that just because we have this trauma to share, there's no reason to feel by ourselves in the sharing of it or in the re-experiencing of it. This is something I actually learned down in Central America when the United States was prosecuting the illegal war against Nicaragua. There were so many women who had experienced trauma at the hands of the Contras, the people who the United States was paying to overthrow the Nicaraguan government. And I was there with an amnesty delegation at one time, and they had these women telling their stories about what had happened to them, and they had them up on a stage all by themselves telling their story. And I was from the Black Women's Health Movement, where we teach about self-help and self-care, but also taking care of each other. So I boldly interrupted the process and said, oh, hell no. You know, they went through this trauma by themselves. Why are we re-traumatizing them by putting them up on a stage by themselves so that we can vicariously hear the story of their trauma? I mean, don't we at least get to stand with her to let her know she's not alone? That what happened to her is not re-happening to her by the way that we're being insensitive. And so this is something that we all, I think, could learn in how we proceed on this journey towards healing. That it's not easy being traumatized, but it's even more difficult when your trauma is offered as a sport for other people's edification. I don't know if I said that well, but that's really from my heart. And so I really appreciate the wisdom of the conference organizers who had the foresight to say that we have mood minders here to help folks. Because that's really special. That's when you take responsibility, not just for yourself, but for our collective community. So thank y'all for putting yourselves forward to be mood minders. And thank y'all for trusting the process. I generally start my presentations by telling you a little bit about my own story. It may sound traumatic, but trust me, I'm way, way over it. So, you know, I'm not telling you this so you can feel sorry for me. But in the car over here, Shayla, I still can't get that name right. Anyway, asked me, well, how did you become active in the movement? And I honestly had to say it wasn't by plan. I'm from a very conservative family. My mother and father were very, very conservative. They're no longer with me. But my father was in the military, a Jamaican immigrant who was uber patriotic. I mean, you know, he was so happy to have made it to the United States, he couldn't help but serve in three wars and get shot up in two of them. And, you know, considered himself the ultimate American. And my mother was so Christian, she believed in faith healing and Pat Robertson and Oral Roberts and all kinds of stuff. So this is not a background that prepared me to be a professional feminist. Not at all. And I'm sure some of you come from equally conservative backgrounds, right? The beauty of my family, though, is that despite our intellectual differences and our emotional differences, we still manage to love each other and be in contact with each other. Not always, because I spent many, many years absolutely pissed off at my parents. And it wasn't until I got into my 30s that I started appreciating that they were doing the best that they could do within the limits of what they had. But I spent all of my teens and my 20s absolutely pissed off at them. But anyway, back to my story, before I start talking about my mom and dad too much. I became pregnant at 14 through incest. A cousin who was supposed to be babysitting me thought it would be a better idea to have sex with me. And this was in the 1960s. So I had very, very few options at that time. Abortion was not legal, but you can imagine that that was not my choice for how I would become a mother. So my only option at that time, as I saw it, was to have my baby and give him up for adoption. And that was very common back then, that when girls became pregnant, they would slide us off to some little hidden place. For me, it was a home for unwed mothers. And then we'd have our babies, we'd give them up for adoption, and then we'd return to high school pretending that we'd just been on extended vacations. Except something went interestingly wrong. The day after my son was born, the nurses made what I always assumed was a mistake, and they bought me my son the day after he was born. And I looked down and I saw his face, and he had my face. I kept saying, "He's got my face, he's got my face. Oh shit, he's got my face." And I found that I couldn't go through with the adoption, you know? And so all the plans I made about going back to school and pretending that I could put all of this behind me and all of that just suddenly went out the window when in that morning in that hospital, I made a decision to parent the child of my rapist. So for 45 years, I've been tethered to my rapist, which is a very interesting way to parent, to say the least. And my son has had to deal with the fact that his father is by no means perfect, was a pedophile. He also is dead now, but he was a pedophile. My son had to deal with that. So we've had a very complicated story, but I really don't regret keeping my son, because a few years later, I was sterilized by a doctor who felt that I'd already had a kid. So it turns out that the child I had was my only chance to become a parent. And, you know, it just teaches you that the universe works in very strange ways, that if that sterilization had happened to me after I'd given my son up for adoption, I probably wouldn't be as... Well, I was already crazy, but I think I would have suicided, because I was always bordering suicide anyway. But I think I would have completed the act if that had happened to me. So my when and where I enter story is that I entered this movement being pissed off by not having choices. You know, because no young girl should be sexually abused by a relative. And once that happens, I should still have choices over whether or not I choose to have a baby. And then I should still have choices if I want to have further children. All of those choices were denied to me before I was even 19 years old. And so I took the rage. I internalized it for a long time. I probably am still internalizing it. You know, I've been in therapy for I don't know how long. I'm probably, you know, the longest standing therapeutic patient in the world. But I'm not ashamed of it because it's kept me here. It kept me sane. And it, you know, has done a whole lot. I mean, my story and certainly my son's story would have turned out much, much differently if I hadn't gotten professional help for the trauma that had happened to me. So I'm not ashamed to say that I am still in therapy every week, talking to the girl that keeps me from suiciding. And I say that kind of humorously, but it's not a joke. It's not a joke. Those of us who experience trauma either self-medicate or we don't. But what we try to do is the best we can do to survive. So moving right along. So I was very lucky that when I went off to college, I went off to college in Washington, D.C., and in 1972, the very first rape crisis center in this country was founded, the D.C. Rape Crisis Center. And a girlfriend of mine who was in the Black Panther Party, Nkinji Ture, convinced me to go over to the Rape Crisis Center as a volunteer. And I have to honestly say that I told Nkinji, I don't want to go over there. I don't want to work with those white women. And Nkinji went, sister, you think a panther would lead you wrong? I was totally intimidated. I mean, this woman broke down weapons and, you know, she was part of the Black Liberation Army. I was trying to figure out what oppression was. You know? So thanks to Nkinji, I ended up over at the D.C. Rape Crisis Center. They taught me that what had happened to me had happened to thousands of other poor Black women across the country, that I wasn't alone, that it was possible to recover from the drama and trauma of my life. They taught me what feminism was. And I've been a professional feminist ever since. And so I don't know, that bio y'all had was a little bit old because I'm actually approaching my 40th year as a feminist, not my 25th. So, but that's all right. I'm an elder in the movement and I take a lot of elder privilege, which is my privilege to sit down while I talk to y'all. I don't have to stand on my feet anymore. You know, it hurts, you know? And so this is my when and where I enter story. This is how I came to be into the movement. And I really appreciate this conference because this conference represents every one of my lived experience, the whole process of claiming ownership, not only of your body, but claiming the necessary social and economic conditions to make sense of your life. You know, because ownership of your body is not enough. You know, yes, so you're not, quote, enslaved, but you can be enslaved by circumstances. You can be enslaved by a disabling environment. You can be enslaved by not having enough money to pay for your health care or your rent. You know, so we have to talk about what does ownership of our body really mean? And what are the necessary enabling conditions we need in order to truly say that it's ours and we get to say what we do and what we won't do. Since 1997, I've been involved with a group of women of color called Sister Song. Sister Song is not a singing group. And I don't care how much I look like a member of Sweet Honey and the Rock, don't even go there. Well, you know, some people think that if you're black and you're dreads and you're fat, you must be Bernice Reagan's sister or something. Not at all. Can't sing. But anyway, you do not want me to sing, trust me. But Sister Song was founded in 1997. By the realization that as small, independent women of color organizations, we were very, very weak. We were mostly volunteer organizations. We didn't have any infrastructure. We didn't have any funding. Yet we were compelled to do what we wanted, what we needed to do in order to serve our communities. So we were Native American, we were African American, Latina, and Asian Pacific Islander women. Some of us were birth mothers, were birthing assistants, doulas, midwives. Some of us were abortion rights activists. Some of us were pro-choice. Some of us were pro-life. I mean, the point was that we were in service to our communities as best that we knew how to be. And so we were lucky enough to get a grant to come together to form our own trade association, figuring out how to work together across all of our diversities, all of our differences. And the reason we were named Sister Song is one of our founders, Juanita Williams, who has lived successfully with HIV/AIDS for 25 years, was observing about our very first meeting. She said, you know, we're all saying the same stuff. We're all complaining about no money, no staff, no respect from the white women, no respect from our communities, how hard the work is, how we're all burnt out. She said, it'd be wonderful if we learned to sing our individual songs in harmony together. And that's where the name Sister Song came from. It's about not singing the same song, because everybody's story is different. It's about learning to sing your song in harmony, in solidarity with other people who are willing and choosing to be in solidarity with you. And so we think it's a wonderful metaphor. We think it's a wonderful way of talking about how to be together differently, because historically, social justice organizing is predicated on the premise that to be with me, you have to agree with me. And Sister Song takes it differently. You can decide what you believe as long as you choose to sit at the table with me. And we learn to sing together. So that's why I can say with pride that we are both pro-choice and pro-life together, which is an interesting combination, as you can imagine. When I say pro-life, though, I'm also putting a caveat attached to it, because what that means is that the people who are pro-life within Sister Song say, basically, I would never have an abortion, but I'm not going to stop another woman from doing what she needs to do. That actually is the majority of people. You know, vast majority of people are very conflicted about abortion because of the success of the right wing of the anti-abortion movement. They have been much more successful than we have in defense of abortion rights. And so they've created this conflict among people, but at the same time, particularly oppressed people know, we understand what it's like when someone else controls your body. So we are not going to join that echo chamber that says, I have the right to impose my views on your body. And so that has allowed us to coexist within Sister Song, where we don't agree with each other's positions, but we agree with each other's rights. Does that make sense to people? And I think that's probably a value that you may want to look at within this movement that I'm encountering for the first time here at Guelph. Is that how you say Guelph? I had to honestly say I had never heard of Guelph till y'all invited me. So forgive me if I get it all wrong. I kept saying, I'm going to a place that's called Guelph. But anyway, it is my geographical ignorance, you know, not the obscurity of your town, I'm sure. Is the translation still working up there? Good. Okay. I guess the mayor will not be giving me the key to the city. One of the things that Sister Song has also pioneered, though, is the concept of reproductive justice. Reproductive justice was actually invented by a group of black women in 1994. And I was fortunate enough to have been a part of those black women, where we were in a hotel room in Chicago, just having returned from the International Conference on Population and Development in Cairo, Egypt. And what we found at the International Conference was that feminists from around the world were using the human rights framework to lay claim to a much more expansive set of rights than we were doing in the United States, only using the privacy framework and the U.S. Constitution. That slaveholder document called the U.S. Constitution has never worked for including us. Actually, it's never worked for including anybody but property-owning white men. And so we've had to do all these amendments about finally including black people. That was the 13th and the 14th Amendment, the 19th Amendment about finally including women's right to vote, though we do not have yet in our Constitution an equal rights amendment which would give women the right to be seen as equal citizens. So there's still a lot of work to be done. I mean, if y'all don't know, your neighbors to the south are some freaked up people. Sorry. Huh? Huh? Yeah, y'all know that, right? I would immigrate to Canada except for y'all's climate. Anyway. Yeah. I just wish they had reversed it. Canada had gotten Florida weather. You know. But then y'all have to set up, you know, walls to keep us all out. Oh, right. Anyway. What we found when we got back from Cairo was that we were very dissatisfied with the isolation of abortion rights from social justice issues, from human rights issues. And this was done often inadvertently by the pro-choice movement, so much so that nowadays the majority of the American public doesn't even see abortion as medical care. They separate it. Like, abortion shouldn't be part of health care reform. It shouldn't be part of health care. And we're like, well, hell, you don't go to an auto mechanic to have one. You go to a medical practitioner. Anytime the person has to have doctor or nurse or something in front of their name, I call that medical care. But not in the United States. And we actually offered a critique of both the pro-choice and the pro-life movement, because they don't really either understand how women actually live our lives. Meaning that every time a woman thinks she is pregnant, she doesn't even have to actually be pregnant, she just has to think she's pregnant. Like, you missed your period and you go, oh my God. Oh my God, I'm late. Oh my God, what am I going to tell my mother? Oh my God, what am I going to tell my partner? Oh my God, can I stay in school? Will I get fired from my job if I decide to keep this? Oh my God. I mean, this is the real conversations that go on in women's heads. When that period is just a little bit late and you know you've been sexually active, and you're like, oh, shit. So you have to pay attention to those oh, my God conversations in order to help the woman make the decision that makes sense for her. The answers to those oh, my God conversations are going to determine whether she's ready to become a parent or not. If she doesn't have health care, if she's worried about getting battered by her partner, she may not be ready to become a parent. And so neither the pro-choice nor the pro-life side pays attention to the conditions in a woman's life before she becomes pregnant. They only take up the cause once she is pregnant. One trying to say, we're giving her choices, and the other saying, we're trying to take away her choices so that she has the baby. But if you don't pay attention to those oh my God comments, those oh my God considerations, you're not giving her choices that make sense. Because it's not a choice to continue a pregnancy if you fear violence, if you fear eviction, if you fear expulsion from school or loss of your job. That's not a choice. And so isolating abortion from women's lived experiences, in our opinion, does not serve women well. And so once we discovered that the international movement was using the human rights framework, we came up with the concept of reproductive justice. And reproductive justice is basically reproductive rights spliced together with social justice to come up with the term reproductive justice. And reproductive justice in an elevator speech is basically the right to have a child, the right not to have a child, and the right to parent the children that you have in safe and healthy environments. Now, we say the right to have a child because we are from communities of color who are always subjected to strategies of population control, where our right to be mothers is often deeply contested because our wombs are blamed for everything, whether it's environmental degradation or the prison industrial complex or the bank crisis. Did you know that we caused Wall Street to fail because we had the temerity to want to buy homes? I mean, we are blamed for everything. But we also joined with the pro-choice movement in fighting for the right to abortion, to birth control, to sex education, to abstinence, if you can hold on. They say it works. I've never abstained from anything in my life. If I didn't do it, it was because I didn't want to do it. But anyway, we share that agenda with the pro-choice movement, the fight for the right to abortion. So reproductive justice is not a way to avoid saying abortion. It just goes beyond abortion. And then we have to fight for the right to parent our children in safe and healthy environment. And the right to parent is a very deep right. Y'all heard earlier from Tina, who talked about the right for incarcerated women to parent, I'm sure. You know, the right for people who are disabled to express their parenting right, trans people to become parents. All of these rights to parent are ways that we have to fight for not only the expression of our desires, but to do so in safe and healthy environments. So that means that we have to fight against gun violence as part of the right to parent, fight against environmental toxins as part of the right to parent, fight against the school to prison pipeline, you know, fight against all these things that jeopardize our children and our right to parent. And so we've created concepts not only like reproductive justice, but birth justice and health justice. All of these things have emanated out of the concept of reproductive justice because we take a much more holistic approach to what control over your body means, because it's not just about your body, but it's about the enabling conditions that are necessary for you to have choices that make sense. Does that make sense to people? It's a much more comprehensive term. And I do want to say that even though reproductive justice was created by women of color, it would be racist to assume that it only applies to women of color. I know this is groundbreaking news, but women of color are capable of creating new theory, new feminist theory, and we have done so, as we've applied critical race theory to reproductive politics and called it reproductive justice. And so, as I said from the outset, this is based on the human rights framework, and I guess I should talk more about that, because most people that we encounter simply don't understand all the categories of human rights to which we are entitled. And let me do a quick test of this audience. How many of you, raise your hands, have heard of the phrase human rights? This is an easy one, y'all. Okay, good. That's just about everybody in the room. Now, having asked that question, how many of you can name the 8 categories of human rights protections to which we are all entitled? I do not see one hand up. Guess what, folks? It's going to be damn hard to fight for rights you can't name. Okay? So, and I want to say, don't feel stupid. It is a conspiracy. I'm kind of like Mel Gibson here. It's a conspiracy. Because there is no reason that people with the educational systems that we enjoy are kept so ignorant of their basic human rights. But we live in countries that are so afraid of us learning about our human rights for fear that we will demand them. And as a matter of fact, when the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was written in 1948 and affirmed by the United Nations, the U.S. Secretary of State at the time was John Foster Dulles, for whom Dulles Airport is named after. And he wrote this advisory, cautionary memo saying we have to be careful about this new human rights thing because we don't want our Negroes to get agitated. Basically, conservatives in the 1940s knew that human rights offered a legal and strong challenge to Jim Crow segregation. And so then they started branding it as a communist plot. Even though First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt had authored the document, they called it a communist plot. And for the next 50 years, insisted that human rights were communist plots being foisted on the free and capitalist West. And under that set of lies, they have kept us from learning about our human rights. And it almost reminds me of something that Harriet Tubman said when somebody was congratulating her on how many slaves she had led to freedom. And she said, well, I could have freed a lot more if they had known they were slaves. And that's the situation we are in. We are enslaved by our ignorance of the human rights that will free us. But we have a chance to do something radical. We have a chance to learn about our human rights. I want to start, though, by giving a little bit more context. The modern concept of human rights was written in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in December 10th, 1948. That's why December 10th is Human Rights Day, because that was the day it was presented to the United Nations. But that was just when the modern concept was written down. But human rights are as old as civilization. When the committee organized by Eleanor Roosevelt was doing its research, it looked at the Bible, it looked at Confucius's writing, the Codes of Hammurabi, the Torah. They looked at every religious tradition to pull together rules that would govern how societies could live peaceably together. And the earliest mention of human rights I've been able to find is in the writings of Frederick Douglass, when in 1858 he protested the lynching of a black man in New York City, and he called it a human rights violation. So 90 years before the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was written, we had black people in the U.S. calling attention to human rights. But the modern concept was formulated after the Nazi genocide of World War II. Because what the Nazi genocide, particularly directed against the Jews and the communists and what they call the homosexuals and the disabled of Germany, what the world recognized was that while the genocide was immoral, it was not illegal. Why? Because governments have a distressing tendency to legitimate immoral actions that they want to do. Think about the genocide of indigenous people in order to take their lands. Immoral, but not illegal. The legitimization of the enslavement of Africans. Immoral, but not illegal. Our war against Iraq. Immoral, but not illegal. This is what governments do to protect their asses. So the world community decided to put in place a set of laws that would make what Nazi Germany did to its own people illegal for the first time. Because up until then, they had what was called a Vegas rule. You know, what happened in Germany stayed in Germany. You know, one country was not allowed to criticize the behaviors of the internal affairs of another country. They call that sovereignty. And for the first time, a body of international law was being created that would override sovereignty and say, wait a moment, hell no, this is not right. I don't care who you think you are to do this to people. And so you have to think about human rights starting out as your deal with your own government. And if you think about the process of genocide, you'll recognize that genocide is not just the killing of a people, which Nazi Germany was very efficient at, unfortunately, but it was all the things that led up to the killing of the people. You know, first they started off with starvation policies, then isolation policies, then kicking them out of schools, not allowing them to be educated, not allowing them to practice their professions, imprisoning them first, ghettoizing them. That's where the term Jewish ghetto comes from. The ghetto was confining Jews to a particular plot of land that they could not go beyond. And all of that was leading up to what was called then the final solution, to kill them. And so we call genocidal the whole process, the starvation, the dismissing from society, the stigmatization, all of that can be called genocide. And the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was written to prevent that. So let me get to the 8 categories quickly, because I may be running out of time. As I told y'all, I can talk. I like to talk. Anyway, in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the first category is called civil rights. Civil rights is the most recognizable set of human rights because it is your right to be treated as an equal to anybody else in society, which is very important. They're your non-discrimination rights. And so we are very aware of civil rights because why? We have had civil rights movements. I would argue that the LGBT movement and the trans movement in particular is a civil rights movement because it's yet to attain simple equality, simple non-discrimination. Yet, I would also argue that you need to be careful because you don't want the LGBT movement to repeat the same mistake that the African American movement made in the United States, and that is fight for only one category of civil rights, of human rights. You need all your human rights to be treated as a full human. So the second category is called political human rights. These are the human rights often expressed through the U.S. Bill of Rights, the freedom of speech, the right to association, the right to vote, But we've recently learned in the United States that we do not have the rights to have our votes counted. Oops. But we got a little bit of ways to go. The third category is called economic human rights. That's the right to have our economy managed in such a way that it meets people's needs. What a radical idea that is. Right now, our economies are being managed in such a way that it meets the needs of Wall Street and the whole Occupy movement, fighting for the 99% of us who are not Wall Street barons, drew grave attention to the human rights violations endemic in how our economy is being managed. And so we've got a long way to work on that as well. The fourth category are called social human rights. These are the human rights born out of our human needs. Our right to food, clothing, shelter, health care, education, welfare, support if we're not able to take care of ourselves. These are, in my mind, some of the most important human rights. And therein, by the way, is why I don't think human rights are being taught in our educational systems. Because if they teach us that education is a human right, then how could they convince us to pay thousands of dollars for something that should be free? So they have a financial incentive not to teach us what our human rights are. They also have a financial incentive in not recognizing that health care is a human right. Now, I know I'm speaking in Canada, where y'all do have universal health care. I wish you could convince your neighbors to the south that this is a good idea. But even this is being under attack and being rolled back, I understand, here in Canada. But the beauty of social human rights, though, is that because they are born out of human needs, they also handle quite well the concept of equality and difference, meaning that every human being has the same human rights. We are no more human than anybody else. But based on our own intersectional identities, we all may need something different to achieve our human rights. Can you believe that every human being has a right to be in this lecture, right? But can you recognize that the sister in the wheelchair needs an ADA, an accessible building, in order for her to be here in this lecture? Obviously. So she doesn't have special human rights. She has special human needs that have to have attention paid to them so that she can achieve the same human rights the rest of us have. And every human being has that special intersectional identity. My own identity was informed by the fact that my parents never went to college, so they never knew how to send a child to college. So as first generation trying to go to college, I had to have special help in order to fill out the application. Yeah. Or I came from a family of 8 kids, so they had to select who could go to college. You know, special needs. And those people who are opposed to human rights try to say that we're asking for special favors or special entitlements. No, we're asking for what was written over 60 years ago, 65 years ago, that the U.S. agreed to and then denied. And, of course, Canada has agreed to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But they take advantage of the fact that we don't know that we have these rights. The fifth category of human rights is called cultural human rights. That's the right to practice the culture of our choice, to speak the language of our choice, to get served in the language of our choice. So though you may not realize it, every time you prepare a flyer in a language other than English, you're actually a human rights defender. You're upholding people's human rights. But cultural human rights also includes freedom of religion, the right to practice the religion of your choice. But it also includes freedom from religion, the right to not have someone else's religion imposed upon you. And this is something that would be very useful for the women's movement and the LGBT movement to learn about. Because right now, our rights are under attack because of the narrow religious views of a minority of people, as they are trying to impose their narrow religious interpretations on our bodies, on the rest of us. They are human rights violators, and we need to learn to term them as such. They claim they're fighting for religious freedom. They're fighting for religious oppression. And we need to understand that. And the other thing I want to say is that they are very adept at misusing the human rights framework by claiming human rights for the preborn or the fetuses. And they get away with that because of our lack of familiarity with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But the opening paragraph of the UDHR very clearly says, all human beings are born equal in rights and dignity. And in 1948, they had the commonsensical approach to recognize that you have to be here to claim the rights. You just can't be some unnamed sperm singing around. You know, the wink in your daddy's eye. No. It doesn't work that way. And they weren't worried about the anti-abortion movement. They were worrying about common sense. You have to be here to claim the rights. And so the sixth category began the new generation of human rights, where people were claiming new categories of rights after the 1940s as new social movements came about. So after the 1970s, people started demanding environmental human rights, the right to a clean environment as the sixth category. Rachel Carson wrote The Silent Spring, that great environmental book. And then all of a sudden, people realized that without clean air and clean water and the right not to live in toxic neighborhoods, you may not be around long to enjoy the rest of your human rights. The seventh category are called developmental human rights. These are the human rights that are demanded by what we used to call the third world, but we now call the developing world. These are the rights they're demanding to control their own natural resources, which are very important human rights. I would argue that the majority of the wars taking place in the world today are taking place because of violations of developmental human rights. I mean, the United States invaded Iraq because we could not explain how our oil got under their sand. We helped overthrow Libya for the same reason. We helped, you know, Egypt, on and on. It's about natural resources. There's a genocide in Darfur taking place right now. And nobody is explaining that this isn't just about tribes who've lived together for hundreds of thousands of years suddenly not liking each other. It is about the fact that the people of Darfur exist on land that contains oil. And the government of China wants that oil. And so they are arming different warlords. And they're going to reward the victor who succeeds in the greatest genocide. And the United States is so indebted to China that we don't even dare say anything negative about what they are doing in Darfur, even though we're supposed to be the leader of human rights around the world. So developmental human rights are important, but it's not just something for overseas. Think about the devastation of the Gulf Coast after Katrina. 60% of the oil that comes into the United States is through the port of New Orleans. And yet, because of corruption and graft, the people of Louisiana are not allowed to properly tax that oil that's coming through their port. If they were allowed to tax the oil at the same rate that the people of Texas tax the oil that comes through the port of Houston, they would not have needed one federal dime to rebuild the entire Gulf Coast. So they have to deal with the environmental catastrophe like the BP oil spill as a violation of their developmental human rights, but they don't get the benefits. That's also a violation of their developmental human rights. And a lot of our energy comes from coal miners. But why do coal miners in all of our countries have the worst health care? The least access to benefits. Again, developmental human rights. And the final category of human rights articulated to date is called sexual human rights. These are my favorite. These are human rights demanded by the women's movement. The right to determine if and when we'll have sex, if and when we'll have children, the right to birth control, the right to abortion, the right to sex education. Even the right to sexual pleasure is a human right, my favorite. Because, you know, it's wonderful to be able to tell your partner, you're not doing it right. You're a human rights violator. Which is kind of fun. Though it does put a little chill in the bedroom. But sexual human rights sounded so good to the LGBTQ movement that they said, well, we want the right to determine what happens to our bodies. We want the right to determine who will have sex, who will love, how we bodily identify. Oh, we want all of those human rights, which is fine. I just offer again that same old cautionary note. Why would you only claim one set of human rights and deny yourself your full humanity? You need all your human rights. And the reason I don't want to portray human rights as a finite set that's closed is because new social movements are constantly appearing that will be demanding new human rights. I actually think that the ninth category of human rights will be the right to participate in information technology, to be digitally connected. I think in about 2 decades, if you are not on the internet or digitally identified, that you're going to be seen as subhuman, that you're going to be deprivileged in all of Western societies. And I think that's right on the horizon. So there will be new categories of human rights, maybe the right to control one's own biologicals, you know, to prevent this biological piracy that's taking place, the way people are patenting people's DNA and stuff like that. That may be another set of human rights we need to talk about. So having said all of that, this is why we saw this happening internationally, what the global feminists were using to lay claim to the same set of rights we were so awkwardly and inadequately talking about in the United States, just using the pro-choice framework. And we were like, wow, why can't we bring human rights home? How can we start having those conversations in the United States? And so that's why we created the reproductive justice framework, which is just another way of saying human rights. Reproductive justice was a way of introducing that conversation into a society that did not have conversations on human rights. But it is not superior to human rights. It is meant simply as a conversational entree. Because human rights is what you want to eventually achieve. Now, of course, in order to achieve human rights, you have to look at the world in an intersectional way. But a lot of people make the mistake thinking that intersectionality is the goal, learning who all your identities are. And that's absolutely not the goal. That's a process. But once you learn all the labels you want to attach to yourself, and I'm telling you, reading this schedule, I saw a lot of labels. Many of whom I'd never seen before. But once you've learned who you are, the question becomes, now what are you going to do with it? Yeah. So it's part of the process of owning oneself. But in order to own oneself successfully and ethically, you have to make up your mind, what am I going to do with this? Because we all have privilege. We all have privilege. Just the fact that we can sit in this forum and offer a strong critique of capitalism and what's going on in our world is a privilege, because just being in this room would have gotten a shot in a lot of countries I've been in. Matter of fact, I've been in one place in El Salvador where the people used our bodies to keep the soldiers from shooting up a women's conference. They used the bodies of Americans. You know, I was in Dubrovnik when the war broke out in Yugoslavia. I've seen people put their lives on the line to have the conversations that we are privileged to have here. So the question becomes, how are we going to responsibly use the privileges that we have? I think by claiming our human rights here, both domestically and challenging the human rights violations that our governments commit abroad. And I would like to challenge the kind of smug attitude that Canadians have towards the United States. I think because the human rights violations Canada commits abroad are so much overwhelmed and by the human rights violations that the United States commits, that less attention is drawn to them, as well as the abuse of human rights of indigenous and aboriginal people here. And so we need to get out of our privileges. I think we're really good as a movement at protesting our pain, but we're not at all good at protesting our privileges, particularly those privileges gained at the expense of someone else. And so I say all of that to say we are all capable of having our human rights violated, but we're equally capable of violating someone else's human rights. We are all, in fact, victimized violators. And we can look at this objectively, but we can also take responsibility for it. We live in a racist, sexist, homophobic, capitalist, you know, ableist, whatever kind of society. I don't know how many isms I can attach to that thing, because this white supremacist construct drives me crazy. But having said all of that, we also live in a land of privileges that are often gained at the expense of people around the world. So thank y'all for letting me talk today, and I hope that you learned something. Thank y'all.